Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great, man. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm all right indeed. I actually went out recently to did a little bar crawl with some friends who were in from out of town.
These are a few of my favorite things.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's funny. I had an interesting experience, and we've talked a lot about bars in the last 10 years. What's happened to bars and cocktail bars is absolutely amazing, and we've seen it go from the craft of making cocktails was once, constrained to Dale DeGroff at the Rainbow Room. Schumann in Germany, maybe two other guys. And now there are cocktail bars in a lot of places. And in Jersey, we've seen in the last 2-3 years, we've seen good cocktails come into Jersey. Amazing. That's
it's
awesome.
It's been fun. Yeah, we had a great event at the restaurant recently where we got about 15 really great bartenders together from New Jersey and shared a lot of experiences. And it was a lot of fun. And you're really getting a sense that the word's getting out there, that people are really starting to not just make these drinks, but to understand them a little bit better. You're really getting people who are learning about the whys, not just the how-tos.
Well, however, that leaves in New York and a lot of places the places that were making cocktails in the beginning. We were one, but we were certainly out in New Jersey. I don't think that we were written about that much beforehand. There are many places several places in New York City who were sort of like the incubators of the cocktail. And there was early on an issue with vodka. I think people shied away, real cocktailians, real mixologists, shied away from vodka and vodka drinks because vodka for so long had been the predominant spirit.
Because everybody was drinking it and ignoring the other spirits in the rack.
And so many cocktails, so many historic cocktails are not made from vodka because vodka wasn't around at the time that those historic cocktails were made. And a lot of people used to use and still use vodka as an alcohol delivery system to bring alcohol to fruit juice who really don't like the drink. So there was a bit of a snobbishness about vodka for a while, but where you really couldn't get it in these places. And that sort of waned as vodka has come back, and there have been some great vodkas that are sort of joining their proper place behind the bar. But a number of things have happened with these cocktail joints that's a little disturbing. Now, some of them are very small, so it's kind of hard to get into them. With some, it's a velvet rope policy. With others, it's just a fact that they're very small and they want to keep a civilized environment, and so it's hard to get in.
Well, some have moved to becoming private clubs. Some have moved to other methods of getting the people in that they want in, whether it be the neighborhood people or the people who are in the private club or however you're going to monitor that. The part of this I think that sometimes people look at, and they looked at this for a long time with restaurants, I think people looked at this, is that people sometimes I think don't understand and they think you're being elitist because you only have a certain amount of room.
Yeah.
And when you're spatially constrained, now Stage Left is pretty big right now, so I have a lot more flexibility than I did when Stage Left was a 40-seat restaurant. And when Stage Left was a 40-seat restaurant, we routinely turned away 200, 300, 400 people on a given night because we were 40 seats. And I think some of those people who are turned away sometimes think, oh, they're snobbish. Or a place has a policy of, we only open up the reservations 30 days in advance because we need to do that because otherwise we'll be constantly inundated with reservations for times that we're booked for. So if you want to book for here, you book 30 days in advance, we open the phone at 9 o'clock, and we turn off the phone when we're booked for that day.
Right.
So I think that sometimes snobbishness has been attributed to some of these small places unfairly.
Well, and it is out there. I mean, you know, Minetta Tavern, it's there. And where else? Just a couple of
You're talking about Waverly Tavern. You're talking about
Yeah. So it's out there, but very often it's not. Places are just too small to handle you. I had an experience last night that's really a first for me, and I can't think
Francis
of
Francis doesn't have
for
a lot of cocktail firsts.
Yeah.
At this point in our lives, there isn't that much new that we see.
I'm perplexed. I went to an old haunt that is a cocktail joint that is I've had many a great experience at, and I've had a couple of mediocre experiences of late. But I went with some friends. I had in a wine writer from Austria, two winemakers from Austria, and a wine importer friend of mine, and we all went. So we're all in the business, right? And everyone there had either worked at a restaurant or a winery. We eat around the world, and cocktails aren't huge in Austria, so these guys said, Francis, take us to some place and show us a real cocktail. So we went to this place, and we ordered a round of cocktails from their menu, what they had on their menu. And then they said, okay, Francis, you know about cocktails. Order us some other cocktails that aren't on the menu, some real American cocktails. And I ordered for the table four classic American cocktails and a fifth cocktail that is a house cocktail for us that's actually been published in Food and Wine magazine in one of their years as one of their top cocktails of the year. And it's basically a Pisco Aperol Sour. We call it a Parasol. And it's Pisco, which is one a spirit that I know the bar has.
Yeah, we'll put the recipe up on the website
sure.
This show.
Well, it's great drink.
So the Parasol will have its recipe up on the website, and I really recommend it, but you need good Pisco.
Yeah, but it's Pisco and Aperol made into a sour. It's a very simple drink. And I know the bar had Pisco, and I know the bar had Aperol. And the woman said, "Yeah, no, I'm sorry, we can't make that. We only make things we have the recipe for." I said, but I just ordered a couple of drinks that aren't on your menu. She said, no, it doesn't have to be on the menu. It has to be something we have the recipe for behind the bar. I said, well, I would just like, it's a sour, but it's a Pisco Aperol sour. She said, we can't do that. And I said, I left it. Okay, fine. But my friend who I was with was not really one to leave things alone. And so she got up and she went over to the bartender, who was kind of the manager, and said, I'm sorry, I don't understand your policy. You have Pisco, and you have Aperol, and you know how to make a sour, because you have all the other ingredients. You'll make a whiskey sour, but you won't make a Pisco Aperol sour. Why is that? He said, well, it has to be a recipe that we have or a recognized cocktail. And she said, what's a recognized cocktail? And he said, well, if it's been published somewhere. So if you could, like, go to the internet and download it on your phone and show me a recipe, then I would make it for you.
So there's a little bit of this, I'm not going to make you what you want.
And that just, then I was like, all right, now I'm befuddled. I don't understand it.
Well, let me take the counterpoint to this argument, though I think their stance is ridiculous.
Okay.
Let me take the counterpoint to this argument just for the sake of discussion. We have, and this has happened in our restaurant, people who say, okay, I'm going to have the steak, but I want the salmon sauce on it. Okay? And for the most part, we just say, okay, we'll happily get that for you.
Yeah.
But how many people have said to you after they had the steak with the salmon sauce on it, this doesn't taste very good?
You know that happens infrequently, though.
But that does happen. Okay? It does. It definitely, there are people who say, after you've made them exactly what they asked you for, say, you know, this doesn't taste good. And, of course, our response to that is, yeah, we know. Of course,
I'd never make that. You know, it's funny because I'm reminded of a story. I had these four older folks come in early one Sunday, got to be 12 years ago, and they sat down and they ordered and they looked at the menu, and they were very loud in their displeasure at our pricing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a bowl of pasta was $20. This is at Stage Left, again, 10 years ago. And Fran Schumer for the New York Times had reviewed our restaurant and opened
right.
the review with a review of this bowl
right.
of linguine.
I drive 35 miles an hour, 35 miles again, all over again, just to get a bowl of this particular thing.
That was the quote from the New York mm-hmm. Times review about this pasta, right? And the pasta was, I think it was $22 or something for a bowl of pasta.
I bet it was less. At that time, I'll bet it was less.
But it wasn't cheap, but it mm-hmm. wasn't crazy, you know. And so they said, we've eaten at the best restaurants in the world, and we've never seen a bowl of pasta for, you know, $20 or $22. And I thought to myself, well, no, you haven't.
You're not eating at the restaurants I'm eating at, because, golly, they slaughter me.
So, but I said, you know, listen, why is this food so expensive? I said, you know, I can't, I'm not going to make excuses for my prices. I buy expensive stuff. I have a well-paid chef in the kitchen. We have a lot of equipment, the linen on the table and the glassware, and that's just what we charge. If you'd like, I'll make you a reservation at another restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, whatever you would like to do, I will do.
I'm just going to interject in the middle of Francis's story, which he can't stand, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Uh-huh.
One of the great things about being in this business
yeah.
is your prices are your prices.
Right.
So it's already agreed upon. It's not like buying a car, buying anything else in the world. Your prices are your prices. It's agreed upon. We don't need to talk about it. If it's too expensive for you, I understand if you don't want to come and you want to go someplace else.
Right.
But if it's priced correctly, you do come. Great.
Right. Well, so these folks say, well, it's ridiculous. And they really thought about going to another place. And I said, listen, there are four other restaurants in town. I'll call and make a reservation for you. I don't want you to stay here if you're not going to be happy here.
Right.
Pay for your drinks and you go. And I didn't say it snootily. I said it like...
You mean like right now?
I was thinking snootily about it, but I was being accommodating. So they decided to stay. And they said, well, we'll try this expensive chef of yours and see if it's worth it. So they proceeded to order food, and they changed every single dish.
They did what I was talking about
before.
They
did exactly what you... We'll have the pasta, but I don't want the olives, and I don't want the tomatoes, and I want some olive oil and butter on the side, and we'll take the salmon, but I don't want this on it, I don't want that on it, change this, and give me this, and change that. And so then we brought
Which,
up...
Which, by the way, we do.
Fine.
We
and
do
I,
it.
And
without a word, we do those things. If you come in and say, for whatever reason, for whether it be an allergy, whether it be I don't like cilantro, whatever the case may be, we will do it. But there's got to be an understanding of this is no longer what I'm doing.
Well,
here's
where we went. So they changed everything, and the food comes over, and then they start talking to the two tables next to them about how terrible we are, how terrible the food is, how arrogant we are to charge those prices. And I walked over to the table because I'm like, okay, this has got to stop. You're not going to be bad-mouthing me in my other place. And the other guys, fortunately for us, and I'll tell you who they were after, but they were friends of ours mm-hmm. on the table who were like, get these annoying people away from me.
Right.
So I walk over to the table, and I said, excuse me, you know, I'm really sorry that you didn't like the food. But, you know, I can't let be walking around to other tables talking
right.
to them. And they said, well, your food isn't very good. I said, sir, you have no idea whether my food is good or not. That's not my food. That's
right.
your food. You know, I don't make that. I don't serve that. I would never put those things
right,
together.
Right, those are bad decisions.
They're your decisions. I don't say they're
right.
good or bad. They're your decisions. But you can't judge me based on you. You changed every item on this menu.
Right. Your steaks were cooked perfectly. Your pasta was cooked to the right temperature. It's salted correctly. But how you arrange the ingredients is not the way I would have.
But by the same token, you asked me to arrange the ingredients that way. And I did. We did. We didn't say, oh, screw them. We'll throw this on here and it'll mm-hmm. be gross. We said, let's try and make this taste as best as we can. So anyway, so I'm at this bar, and I thought to myself, and here was the game I played with my.
Do you realize we told four stories inside this story?
I know.
Welcome to Francis and Mark, everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
If you ever want to see us in real life, literally one story will begin, four stories will be told, and then that story will end.
Well, and so here's the ending of the story. So we go up to the original story. We go up to the bar, and I said, okay, so you'll make me a whiskey sour. Yes, I will. You'll make me a scotch sour. Yes, I will. You'll make me a bourbon sour. Yes, I will. Will you make me a Pisco sour? Yes, I will.
Oh, you're really pushing it now.
Will you make me an Aperol sour? No. Oh, you just won't. Will you make me a whiskey sour but use Aperol instead of the whiskey? No. Will you make me a Pisco sour and put a little Aperol in it? No. Okay. I've got to go now.
Uncle, you win.
And I thought...
You win. Of course, what you win is... I'm going.
I don't get it.
Oh, here's what I believe. Okay, and you want to know the philosophies of my restaurants? Here's my philosophies of my restaurant. Everything in my restaurant has a recipe. There is a certain way that I do everything, and all my bartenders will conform to that particular recipe
right.
in that particular way. And if you come in and you say, you know what, I like my martinis dirtier than you make your dirty martinis. I'd like it really dirty. Okay, I'll put more of the brine into your dirty martini. Absolutely. You know what? I like my martini shaken. You guys stir them. Will you shake my martini? Okay, we'll shake your martini. So there's a house style. There's a house recipe for everything. But if you want something that's your way, that's going to make you happy,
I'm going to try and do that. But here's the policy that I do understand. Sometimes we'll hire a bartender, and the bartender will say, yeah, well, I don't make my cosmopolitans that way. This is the way I make my cosmopolitans. And my response is, and when you buy your bar, you can make your cosmopolitans that way. And
well, you want everything to be the same.
Well, and what
you
I
want when somebody comes into your bar on Tuesday night or Saturday night for them to be able to have the same expectations, just like they do with the food. You wouldn't expect that if you ordered the duck on my menu on Tuesday and JR was cooking it, that it'd be different on Saturday when Ricky was cooking it.
Yeah. Oh, different chef. Oh, that's why it's different.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Ricky really likes salt. Sorry.
Well, but the other thing we do is we don't try to stifle creativity among our bartenders. Some great stuff has come out of our bartenders. But when bartenders think that they can make the drink better or they have a better version of the drink, what they need to do is bring it to all of us in a meeting and say, you know what, let's change the way we make our cosmopolitans. Because what you don't want is, oh, I come on Tuesday nights because Jim's working on Tuesdays, but I don't like Megan's the way she does this. So I understand saying bartenders can't freelance unless the customer asks. But you don't say the customer, because the bartender works for you. You work for the customer. So, anyway, that I just thought that was a strange and disturbing trend. I hope it doesn't take
I don't think it's a trend. I just think that it's a bartender on a given night
no,
in that place.
No, it's the policy of the place. It's the policy.
You know what? You know how many times I've heard it's the policy of the place, and then you talk to the right person, and you find out it's not the policy of the place?
Well, we know the right person, so we'll see we'll see that person soon, and we'll ask that person. Anyway, so we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And today we're speaking with Janet London. Janet is an experienced natural foods organizer and leader who designed Purple Dragon, a revolutionary food co-op with over 1,000 members in New Jersey and southern New York. Today she's going to discuss how this business model works and how she gets some great produce. And I will tell you in the spirit of full disclosure that Mark Pascal and his family are members of this co-op.
Hey, Janet. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, part of the genesis of how we got you on the show or why we decided to get you on the show is because Mark's been fascinated with your business model for a long time, and it's really a little different than other business models we've talked about. We've had a lot of CSAs on. We've had Farmer John on. We've had Deborah Coons Garcia on to talk about different ways that we can get natural and sustainable foods and healthy foods to our families. But your business model is a little different, and before I ask you to explain it, what I want to tell you is that, you know, Mark and I go to the Green Market for our restaurants in season, or we have some go to the Green Market every Wednesday. We have a lot of relationships with local farmers. We have local farmers who plant on our behalf for our restaurants. We put up our own fruit in the summertime for use in the wintertime. And there are many times when Mark, who you'd think would be a little bit jaded and hard to please, comes in and says, you know, my wife just got from the co-op today. Try these. And the food is always really delicious.
The grapefruits are ridiculous.
So let's talk about your model and what Purple Dragon is.
Okay, well, you know, first of all, I want to say where I came from, so how I came to developing this. Years ago, I lived in Berkeley, and I worked at Westbury Natural Foods, so that was my beginning. I also shopped, I was also part of what they called the food conspiracy there, and went and shopped at the farmers market in San Francisco. And then from there, I moved to Texas, where I started a small organic produce company, and then ended up running a store called Hobbit Hole with one of the three people who ended up starting Whole Foods. And he had never been in a health food store before in his life. So I had trained him, and then, not 100% happy with where they went with it, but that's another story. But anyway, then moved out here and was involved with Park Slope Food Co-op and the 16th Street Co-op in Brooklyn, and ran a health food store in Manhattan. And when I got to New Jersey, I don't know, it was like this desert. So I was looking for a way to get better food for my friends and my family, and sat around and thought about it a lot, you know, what kind of a model I was going to use. And with a very small child, I didn't want to have a store because that you'd have to be at the store all the time. So I developed this model, and, you know, it took a lot of thinking. And nowadays it gets copied a lot, and people think, oh, this is a co-op, and this is how a co-op is designed. But, you know, actually as a singer-songwriter and an artist, you know, you try to bring something new to things, and that's how I came up with this model. So we work with a lot of small farms in the area, and then, you know, off-season we work with farms farther away. These days we have a really great relationship with an organic farm in Florida, and it's been wonderful. We've been getting a lot of really good food from them at very good prices. And it makes a lot of sense off-season rather than bringing things all the way in from California, you know, when possible.
Can you tell people exactly how your pod system works? I mean, it's a real, to me, it's such an interesting system to deliver food to one location nearby and then have for it to be truly a co-op, where how that works.
So we organize neighborhood groups of families. And if families are in a neighborhood where we don't have a group, we'll work with them to organize one. One thing I realized being part of Park Slope Food Co-op was some people did more work and some people would naturally do less work, even if they both were supposed to do the same. So I wanted to recognize that fact within our co-op. So we have the families that host the pods, and they get a discount for doing that. And then if the group is a weekday group where members have to be at their jobs and can't share the dividing duty, then the dividers get a discount also. So it's, you know, a system of steps of discounts depending on, you know, what you contribute to the co-op in terms of your time.
Let me interject here for just a moment and give our listeners an overview of how this pod system works. What this co-op does is there is no store, there is no physical co-op, but Purple Dragon organizes purchasing of foods and fruits and vegetables and the like. And you get a basket of food. You don't like a CSA farm. You don't necessarily get to say, okay, I'll have two grapefruits and three pears and a dozen lemons.
You get today's mixed basket.
You get today's mixed basket, which allows the co-op to buy food in a large enough quantity that it makes sense and to put together from what's available. And you know that a basket of food that is reasonable and something that a family of would use over the course of a week.
2 weeks.
Or 2 weeks. But, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, exactly what you want when you want it, which is really interesting.
But it really is, because it really is exactly what you want when you want it, because what it is it's the things that are freshest, it's the things that are in season, it's the things that make
right.
sense.
And
one
the things that the farmers are asking us to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's that's where I was going with this, was it is a very natural way to eat. It's the idea of, you know, if you want to eat Pop-Tarts, you can have whatever flavor you want at whatever, you know, whatever time of year it is. But if you want to eat naturally and locally and in tune with the environment and what's coming out, even though this isn't necessarily from a local farm, if you're buying only from local farms, things can be a little bleak in February. It is about having variety in your diet and a little sort of surprise. And you should have different things come your way.
It's true that I had never tried a kiwi before I started the co-op. And one time a supplier asked me, well, don't you like a sweet sour flavor? And I said, oh, my God, that's my favorite kind of flavor. So then I became a kiwi addict. Right, so we buy from, you know, in season from the small regional farms. And the season can go pretty long. I mean, we can get regional apples, you know, 12 months of the year. And depending on what they're offering us, and then we go in ever-widening circles seeing what's out there for the members, that's good. And then once in a while, you know, we'll try to put something really wonderful in. Like, we just were able to afford to give everyone Meyer lemons for the first time.
Oh, that's great.
Which, yeah, they're kind of an orangey, lemony lemon. And, you know, you just add a little agave and makes a fabulous salad dressing.
Hey, Janet.
Yeah.
We didn't get any. I'm just teasing you.
Did you really not?
No, I'm not sure.
Every
couple of weeks, my wife tells me what I'm eating. I say thank you very much.
Right, in the restaurant, Mark's in charge. At home, that not so much.
Well, it depends. You know, there's a newsletter that comes with your bag, which is a good point, and it tells you what's in the share. So if you don't read it, you might think it was a regular lemon that you got. Or one group, they arrived kind of ripe, so kind of orangey, and they thought that, you know, there was something wrong with them or that they were not lemons.
Well, but it's great, and it encourages you. One of the things about this kind of mixed basket that you've created is it encourages you to eat foods that you might not otherwise eat. You know, I'm sure that there are people who got kohlrabi the first time in your market basket, or certain types of squashes, or some of the more interesting foods that are completely in season, wonderful, for the first time in their lives. You know, you're talking about kiwis, but there are lots of other things that people might be experiencing for the first time in their life.
Well, I'm definitely one of them. I mean, you know, as I learn, so the co-op learns. I mean, I only tried kohlrabi for the first time a couple of years ago, and I was wowed by it. But, you know, I got into rutabagas. I said, you know, I have to try these. I mean, it's a traditional food. it has been used for so long in this country and other countries, and, you know, finally tried them and became an addict. So I guess that's what I'm saying about everything I've tried. It is a way, and also it's a way of helping the farmers, because the farmer can say to me, listen, you know, our broccoli is coming on really strong, and then we're supposed to get a big freeze next week. Can you give your people double broccoli? So everyone gets two bunches. I mean, there's nothing bad about that. And so we can really support the farms, because, you know, when they have a lot of something, then we can have a lot of it. And it's just kind of like having your own backyard garden, except someone else is doing the growing and you're doing whatever your job is.
And if you look back in all of human history, there is a cycle of eating what comes out of the ground. In other words, we talk about, you know, the celebration of the abundance of the harvest. That's the idea of the ground has given us this great stuff. And that's what we eat now, because that's what's come about. And the cause for a feast was often the fact that you had that much food in the first place. And you know, we've really lost touch with that, when we expect to be able to feast whenever we want to and whatever we want to. And I think being tied to, or having your food come to you is sort of in a way that's tied to the land is pretty interesting. And I think life-affirming. Now, another difference, you know, the CSA model we've dealt with in the back, the community-supported agriculture, where people in a community, they come in and they pay a fee to join a farm, and the farmer uses that money to produce the food that is then doled out over the course of a year. Your model is different from that as well, in that you don't really require the upfront payments.
Right, right. Our model is supposed to be user-friendly on a lot of levels. So people pay week by week. Everyone pays in advance to their host family. And then it's also supposed to be user-friendly that it does provide the discount to the host family, so that we feel that no one should be denied organic food and regional food if they want it. All they have to do is host a group, and then they get a very large discount for taking that responsibility on, to where I've had people tell me, you know, especially women, that their family might not have eaten had they not been in the co-op. So,
wow.
You know, we want to make it available to everyone, and we want to be able to go into every community. You know, I felt for a long time, for example, Newark was underserved. Now we have two groups in Newark. I'm happy to see, you know, because and we're getting, you know, more people. I mean, we have so many cultures in New Jersey. More people from different cultures are approaching us about having groups, and we're so happy to see that, and hopefully we'll be able to serve them, because I know, you know, different cultures all have different food styles.
Well, there are two parts of this, too. First of all, it's 12 months a year. You know, France is talking about a CSA. Obviously, a CSA in New Jersey can't be a 12-month-a-year facility. You're creating something that delivers to your house every 2 weeks, all 12 months a year.
Well, delivers to the neighborhood.
I'm sorry, delivers to the neighborhood pickup point.
That is one way we found that we save people a lot of money, that we go to the one place and the members pick up from there, rather than if we went to every house, it would almost double the cost, so it didn't seem like a good choice.
And let's talk about the cost. It's really, when you look at what you get, you know, somewhere between 15 and 30 pounds of produce arrives every 2 weeks, and it's $47, do I have the number right? Is that the?
It depends. If it's a group where you take a turn dividing every 3 months, then it's 47. If you never have to take a turn dividing, then it's 49, because the extra $2 goes to the dividers for doing that. But, I actually had a nice email recently from someone who said she lost her job and she was thinking of dropping out of the co-op, and then she sat and thought about what a good value it was and decided that she would stay in. So that makes me really proud to have people, you know, recognize it like that, because, you know, no one here makes a lot of money. We all work really hard, and, you know, we want to be that for people. We want to be something that's affordable for everyone, that's providing a really good value, and that's very supportive to the farmers. I mean, certain large companies have recently publicized that they make low-interest loans to farmers. We've been making interest-free loans to some farmers on a handshake for years. And, you know, we just feel that that's part of our duty of supporting the local ag, is to make that available, you know, to the farmers and to the members.
For a lot of people, this is kind of a new idea, but this really isn't a new idea for you. You've been doing this for a while, huh?
Purple Dragon, I think it's like either 22 or 23 years old at this point.
Yeah, I've only been on board for about three of them. So, but I, you know, I just absolutely love what you've created, and you know, I talk to Francis about it all the time off the air and in the restaurant about the quality of the things you bring, And again, we talk about affordability, and $47 sounds like a lot of money, I think, to some people when you're talking about, you know, picking up a box of produce. But when you start breaking it down by the pound, and when you start talking about the fact that you can be one of these host families where you're the person who does the dividing every week, you're the place that the stuff comes and gets picked up from. And basically how it works is it's somebody's garage, and you go there at your leisure. You have a key code to their garage. You go into their garage, pick up your box, leave your check, and leave with the produce. So for some of these host families, I mean, you're talking about where it comes down to a dollar a pound or less for some really spectacular produce.
Right, they can save people time, too. I mean, if you're busy and you're working in Manhattan all day, you know, you can scoot by at the end of the day, grab your box, and go home and not have to have spent an hour in the grocery store.
Well, now, Purple Dragon serves New York and Southern New York and New Jersey, and if people wanted to sign up for Purple Dragon, get involved in Purple Dragon,
or start their own pod.
Or maybe get some information from you as to how to start something in their neighborhood, where's the website? Where do they go?
It's
how do they find it?
PurpleDragon.com.
And no actual Purple Dragons were killed in the making of this?
No.
But no. Okay.
Taking good care of them.
Now, Janet, you've started another little project, haven't you?
Right.
A new natural foods project as well.
Right. Working with organic farmer Blueberry Dave, we started a second company called Blue Earth Local Natural Foods, and we're making processed foods out of regional ingredients. You know, especially at the end of the season when a farmer has a surfeit of, like, say, number two tomatoes, you know, things that aren't pretty enough to sell, but they're perfect for cooking, you know, we'll grab them and... we've made a bunch of organic and natural regional products. So we made a tomato sauce, an organic heirloom tomato sauce. I mean, forgive me for saying this, but it is to die for. You know, it has all that sweetness of the heirloom tomatoes. It's really thick, and, you know, you put that with a little Parmigiano-Reggiano and whole wheat pasta, and it's just heavenly.
So I'm going to ask selfishly, is this something that Purple Dragon members can get delivered?
Yes, members can order these things, and, you know, we're open to any... stores that would like to carry these products, and we have also a salsa verde, a salsa, a ketchup with heirloom tomatoes and garlic, a New York Eco apple butter from Amy Hepworth's apples, and then we also made a New Jersey organic blueberry butter, which we sweetened with organic Concord grape juice, which Blueberry Dave points out to me, those are the two indigenous fruits, Concord grapes and blueberries.
Can you explain what an eco apple is?
Oh, it's a really long explanation. the organic standards were developed in California, which is a desert climate. And when you try to replicate the same growing techniques here, you run into a lot of problems. You have different pest problems with the increased humidity. And so in the organic rule, you can use pyrethrin when you have certain pest problems. And if you just have to use it a couple times a season, it's not a big deal. But pyrethrins are a full-spectrum insecticide. It means it kills every insect with which it comes in contact. So if you have to keep using them, you're going to wipe out all the insects that have nothing to do with the problem, your ants, your moths, your butterflies, you know, anything. And so what a lot of the East Coast orchard farms have done is very cutting edge and brave, because it means that they can't say we're certified organic, but they feel much more moral because they're doing something that's more in harmony with the environment. I mean, the organic rule is, you know, not perfect, doesn't work in every situation. They will use something that's very quickly biodegrading, that's pest specific, and use that to solve the problem rather than, you know, use pyrethrin. And so they can't say they're organic, so they have to say their eco or whatever other nomenclature they use.
Fascinating.
But Amy Hepworth Farms, I mean, she was written up in New York Magazine. She's, you know, very well-known fifth-generation orchardist, and they also have organic crops on their farm, but for their orchards, they're often eco.
Well, again, one of the things that I really enjoy about the co-op is it's sensible, okay? If the word organic doesn't make sense for a certain situation, as long as people are following sensible guidelines, those are foods that you will put into this market basket.
That's a really good point, because years ago when we started working with Hepworth and other East Coast orchards, you know, we were faced with the choice. Do we want to bring in Washington State certified organic apples and we're
going
to drag them 3,000 miles across the country, use all that fossil fuel, or should we buy a very clean regional apple? And we thought that that was a very sensible choice. But
well,
that's really, thank you for bringing that up.
Well, you can find more about Purple Dragon and Janet London's work if you go to purpledragon.com. We'll link to it through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. Janet, thank you for coming on the show.
I'm totally charmed, and I've become a fan of your show.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work. Vinfinity system for restaurants and bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Amy Sutherland. She has written a book, Cook-Off, Recipe Fever in America, What Shamu Taught Me About a Happy Marriage, and she's been recently quoted in the New York Times talking about recipe contests throughout America.
Amy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. We decided to call you up when we saw you quoted in the recent article in the Times, which talks about sort of recipe cook-off fever. Now, your credibility as an expert on recipe cook-offs dates back from your book and your involvement with the Pillsbury Bake-Off, which is probably the bake-off of America, right?
Right. Yeah, it has the biggest grand prize of $1 million.
Wow.
That's a hell of a cake.
I'm thinking maybe I'll enter next year into the Pillsbury.
I think that should be everybody's plan B.
why don't we start out by talking about this old. Now, how long has the Pillsbury Bake Off been around?
It was started in the late 40s as a big just publicity event for Pillsbury, and GE was in on the start too, donating the use of the stoves. And it was meant as just a one-time event, but it just got such tremendous coverage and interest that, it's been with us ever since.
How does it go from being a one-time event sort of thing to $1 million annually?
Well, you know, the $1 million grand prize was from when the British company, I'm sorry, the name's going to escape me, that bought Pillsbury. And every time Pillsbury has changed hands or there's actually anything that goes on with the company, all the people interested in the bake-off start to really worry what's going to happen. Is the bake-off on its way out? But in this case, when the British company bought it, it decided to really go for it and, you know, and came up with that $1 million grand prize. And the first person to win it was the first man who ever won the bake-off, Kurt Wade. But, you know, in the beginning days, I believe it was just 100,000 that first year, if that, actually. But it's been going the longest, it's the second longest of any of the big standing cook-offs. And it's just had such tremendous interest that I think it can afford the $1 million grand prize.
Besides the prize, why are people so interested in a cook-off like this?
Well, it's really an American phenomenon. There's no other country in the world that competes at the stove like we do. It's really about who we are as a people and who we are as cooks. And I think the reason that the cook-offs appeal to us, I mean, Pillsbury beyond the $1 million, is that we have a long history of cooking competitively in this country, starting with the state fairs in the 19th century. So there's somebody's usually got an aunt or a grandmother or somebody in their family who's done this at some point. And then the other thing is that Americans are just really, by nature, competitive. We like to compete in all things, so it just kind of naturally flows over to the kitchen.
Well, you know, I think there are analogies. In the article in the Times last month, mm-hmm. where they were talking about that it's kind of gone hyper with the advent of the internet and places like meetup.com.
Right.
We have things like they mentioned different contests. An article by Stephen Stern on May 13th, 2009. He talks about the tofu takedown in the Highline Ballroom, you know. And the prize there is like $50, you know?
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the thing, is that there's plenty of these events where there's no prize at all. The only prize is just winning.
But have you seen, as they talk about, as Stern talks about in this article, the rise in competitive cooking, not just the top chef and the new top chef and the biggest top chef and the tippy top chef, you know, that we have in Hell's Kitchen, but in, you know, average people getting involved in cook-offs.
Yeah, it just keeps growing. I mean, it's sort of something that people would have expected to go away when women went back to work in large force, but it's actually gotten stronger. And I think that's got to do with the way the internet's made it so much easier to find out about these cook-offs,
mm-hmm.
whether they be your you know, a local tofu throwdown or the national chicken cook-off. And then the other thing is just that, you know, cooking for a lot of people has become more of a hobby, and this becomes kind of an outlet for that hobby.
So
even though as day-to-day cooking maybe is on the decline, the people who cook tend to do it as a serious hobby, and they like to sort of flex their muscles, and this also becomes a social way to do it.
Amy, in the professional world, we see primarily male competitors in the professional contest. Not exclusively, but certainly
right,
the majority.
The chefs,
exactly. In these amateur cook-offs, are you seeing more females, more males? What's the dynamic?
It depends on the world, the cook-off world. If you're talking about like the Pillsbury Bake-Off and the National Chicken Cook-Off and the likes of those are primarily still women, although there have been a small growth in the number of men entering them. If you're talking about the barbecue world, then it becomes largely men again.
Well, that's the man's
and then,
domain.
Oddly, the chili world is the most democratic with men and women.
Well, and chili and barbecue contests are really barbecue contests are really crazy.
And also chili. I mean, I have to say that I considered it quite an accomplishment that I made it out of the various chili cook-offs down in Terlingua in one piece.
How so? What were they like?
Oh my God! I heard things yelled in the middle of the night that I can't repeat on your show. It's just like it's funny. They're deadly serious, but I've never seen. Although barbecue is a close contender, second runner-up, but I've never seen so much drinking while people were competing.
Yeah.
And so they would have, like, their humongous bottle of Jack next to their chili pot, but then they would do this thing called dumps where they would measure out their spice mixes in advance so that then they would just set their timer, and if they had too much to drink, then they still, when the timer went off, they just reached over and threw in the next dump.
You know, I'd like to contrast that for a moment. We were recently down at Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans. And for the competitions, nobody drinks.
That's right.
Now, after the competitions, you drink your face off.
Everybody drinks.
But the cocktail competitions are serious chemistry, and they're deadly serious. Nobody drinks during the cocktail competition.
Yeah.
But then they drink until the not-so-wee hours of the morning afterwards.
Right. It's not that common that people on cook-offs have a big bottle of Jack next to their and for a lot of reasons. Definitely not at the Pillsbury Bake Off.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well,
they're afraid they're drinking too much coffee. So.
Well, in the article, they mentioned things like the contests I've mentioned, plus the Park Slope Cook-Off, the Monday Night Cupcake Cook-Off, mm-hmm. the Fondue Takedown, the Risotto Challenge, the Chowder Slam. And the cassoulet cook-off, the ramen off, I don't know. I think these things are a lot of fun, and I really enjoy them. But I just tend to think that we don't get it. Americans, why do we need to make everything a contest? You know, it's funny. Okay, take wine, for example.
Right.
Europeans drank wine, and it wasn't a big part of our culture for a long time, but Europeans drank wine for thousands of years, and they never had a 100-point scoring system. and they never had a top 10 list of this and top 10 list of that, and you're the, and you, you know, you had 87 points, but you had 89 points, and there was never a contest element to it. We took wine and we became one of the driving wine market in the world, and we did it by pitting wines against each other, like pit bulls. You know, I have a 95-point Chardonnay. Well, I have a 97-point Chardonnay. Right. And now with the cook-off thing and all the celebrity chefs cooking off, all the amateur chefs cooking off, to me there's something fundamentally missing about what cooking great food is all about. It's fun once in a while, but I think we're overdoing it? What's your opinion?
I mean, I can see your point, but I guess to me I put this in a different category in that, I mean, there is some great food that comes out of these contests. There's some really not great food that comes out of these contests. But the point is that it's basically food as entertainment and socializing. I mean, it is competition, but for us Americans, competition is socializing and entertainment. And that's how we're very different from Europeans, and that's what I thought was so cool about these contests, is that it was a real kind of everyday way in which our American spirit sort of bubbles up out of us.
I still think that maybe that there's too much competition. Francis and I were recently out to dinner with some friends, and there was a woman at the table who, as we were all enjoying dessert, she was getting a little bit agitated. And I was sitting there going, why is she getting a little bit agitated? And she finally divulged the secret. She said, people are enjoying desserts and they're not mine. And I thought, wow.
Sweetie pie.
Yeah. You got to loosen up. We're at a restaurant.
We got to have a talk.
I don't know. You know, you got, for women in America, for the longest time, this was the only way you, like, you know, had accomplishment.
To distinguish yourself.
Yeah, I mean, was, you know, that you were considered a good cook. And then a way to show that you were a good cook to the world was to enter the state fair. You know, so I think it's going to be a long time before that's out of our system.
Well, in the meantime, I'll keep going to those competitions. Not to compete, just to eat the results of the food. That's my favorite thing. Well, Ms. Sutherland, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
It was a pleasure to have you. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis.
You know, a few years ago, Francis, do you remember we got asked to do the New Jersey Mayor's Cook-Off Challenge?
Oh, yeah.
It was challenging.
Yeah, for us. Yeah, I do remember that.
Amateur cooks trying to do things the way professionals do them, I think, is always a mistake. I think it's always a good idea to try and do something that's more homey, that's more consumer-friendly than necessarily trying to think outside the box. And I remember that cook-off, the dishes that succeeded were more of what you would eat at home as opposed to what you would necessarily eat out in a restaurant.
Well, and for a number of reasons. When you go to a cook-off, remember that you're going to operate in an unfamiliar environment with an unfamiliar cooking apparatus, and if you need to plate up several versions, multiple plates of something, it's very hard to be consistent if you're not in a consistent in the place where you're used to cooking. And so I think that's one of the reasons that barbecue and chili our major standing contests that we've had in America for a long time, mm-hmm. because the vessel is standard, and it is easily scalable.
It's not just that. There's also one other thing that I think is really important to most of these cooking contests, is it can cook for a really long time. You can taste people on it over an hour. I mean, if
right.
you cook, if it's a chili, you can taste people on it at 12 o'clock noon and at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and
right.
have that same big pot of chili working over the fire and still have it be relatively the same.
But you're cooking a piece of fish.
Right.
And the other thing about these contests, and one of the things that we've talked behind the scenes with friends of ours who judge food contests on television, some of those shows you see on television, is the chefs make the dish. And there can be sometimes while they get camera angles, while they're waiting for other dishes to be done, those dishes are sometimes judged, and the judges account for this, and they're not coming right off the stove and going
right.
out to the judge's plate. So those dishes can be 15 minutes old. 15 minutes to a piece of cooked fish can be death, depending on the fish.
Could be completely dead. Could
you know,
be.
Your butter can go from melted and part of the
right.
part
a
of the dish.
A lovely melted sauce to a congealed bloop.
Yeah, no, it's so I think when doing contests, as I say, when doing food at home for your barbecue or whatever, it's things that scale up easily. And I think when people make a mistake, it's they, you know, doing restaurant production, making that one dish one time for five people at your dinner table, that sort of works. But if you're doing it and you don't have complete control of the environment, the dish is going to die on you, which is should give you more respect for what great restaurants do every day of the week, because that's exactly what would happen.
Because every time a dish, every once in a while, a dish dies on
yeah,
you. You know
yeah.
what we do in a restaurant? We throw it away.
Start again.
Start over.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the last hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.